Randy Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer, on News Talk STL.
Hey, welcome back to the program. Coming up, we'll be talking with Virginia Cruda, of course, contributor to the Daily Wire, and Rainer Zittelmann, an ambassador for capitalism, but talks to us from Germany with a new book on that. Boy, we need some celebration of capitalism, don't we? And then Bill Eigel in the 8 o'clock hour at 8:25, so you'll want to stick with us all morning. Joining us now is Steve Camerata, who is the director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies. I have the center bookmarked on my favorites bar. That's how important it is that you stay in touch with the work that Steve and all the great people are doing there. Welcome back into the program, Steve. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me back.
Hey, I was looking at a new report that you guys have put out, and man, was I was really surprised to see the magnitude of the numbers, number one, but also the economic misinformation that is out there by people that say that, immigration and foreign-born folks are a net positive on the economy and how great it is, and we need more people coming in. I thought, holy cow, some of the economic numbers were really startling as well. Let's talk about the report just out in terms of the number of foreign-born or immigrant population and what it's done under the Biden administration.
Yeah, so what we're using here is the household survey, the one that we collect like unemployment data from, but it surveys the whole population. And in case your listeners are wondering, it's well established that it does capture many millions of illegal immigrants. How many people get missed by the survey is a long discussion, but it does do a pretty good job of giving us a sense of what's going on overall in the country. And what it shows is that the foreign-born population in the United States is up 6.6 million since Joe Biden took office in January of 2021. And this is data comes from March of 2024. So it's very updated. And the foreign-born is everybody who's not a U.S. citizen at birth. So it would include illegal aliens. It includes legal immigrants. And it includes temporary visitors and things like that. Just long-term temporary visitors, like foreign students and stuff. Anyway, what I think the really amazing thing is A, that growth. It's never grown like this before in American history at this pace like that. Because remember, for it to grow nearly 6 million, grow nearly 7 million, a lot more than 7 million people have to come in each year or in the last 3 years, because people go home and some people die every year. So this is the net increase, not the number of new arrivals. And other interesting facts about the nearly 52 million is that it's almost 16% of the U.S. population. So we have blown past all prior records, even the so-called Great Wave between, say, 1880 and 1920. Back then, the foreign-born never went above 15%. So we have never been here before, and we're heading ever more rapidly into uncharted territory. Now, in terms of the issue that you were really interested in and wanted to talk about, was that people imagine that, well, they're all workers, right? Sometimes people who want to minimize the impact on American society say, well, they're all workers. But the data actually lets us know that information. And of the people who said they arrived in the last 2 years, only 46% were actually working. That means 54% of all the recently arrived immigrants are not working. Now, that isn't quite as shocking and surprising as you might think, because as in any human population, many newly arrived immigrants are children, elderly, disabled, caregivers, or others who have no ability to work or interest in doing so. In other words, it's not that surprising this is the case, but it's a reminder of something critically important about immigration. Immigrants are not just simply workers. They're not just simply factors in production. They're people. And as people, they impact everything from our schools and hospitals to our politics and our culture. They don't just show up at the workplace and work and then somehow vanish at the end of the day. And so that's an important reminder. And that 46% or the 54% who don't work, you know, I think really is striking, because it does remind us of that basic common sense but often ignored fact.
You know, what's interesting to me, too, is when you talk to folks who are the most elderly of the elderly and are the closest to the great waves of immigration, they describe, Steve, qualitatively a different expectation and assimilation quotient, if you will, among those first and second great waves of immigrants, and more of an assimilation with the expectation that they were going to adopt those first principles of American existence and presence, with citizenship or not. But they did aspire for citizenship. But they brought skill sets, and they brought an expectation that they were going to contribute to a society, well, at that time didn't have the same safety net, as I like to say, that is now a hammock, not a safety net. But there was a different worldview. It was that sort of old world Western, you know, I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstrap, burn the midnight oil, depend on myself and my family and my church and my community, and not the government. Is it fair to say that this wave of immigration may have a different worldview, a different set of expectations of what their life in America looks like afterwards, or is that not an accurate description?
It's a very complex picture, and clearly many immigrants contribute. Clearly there's all kinds of assimilation and integration that does go on, and it would be unfair and unreasonable to say that's not the case. But let me highlight the key differences. One is the numbers. We've never been here before. We've never grown this rapidly. And so the scale of immigration to the United States is very much can overwhelm the assimilation process. Two is just technology. You can call home. You can visit home. You can, you know, fly home for Christmas and fly home for the summer and come back. 120 years ago, that just wasn't possible in the same way at the cost. So the connection with the home country became more attenuated more quickly in a way that it's not. And one of the other big differences today is that we have an elite that in some ways does, you know, talks about every problem, every flaw, every failure of America, and doesn't celebrate American history. In the past, immigrants arrived in a country that was proud of what it had done. Today, immigrants are arriving in a country where at least a large share of the elites, not necessarily the public, but a large share of the elites are very ashamed and embarrassed by a country. And that matters a lot. And that is also reinforced by the rise of grievance and identity-based politics that didn't exist in the same way. Now, again, that mass immigration we had in the last, 120 years ago was very disruptive to our society in some ways. We shouldn't sugarcoat it. That's when my family came. And we shouldn't say, and there were losers from that. One of the biggest losers from that, like one of the biggest people who tend to be worse off as a result of today's immigration, were Black Americans. Just a quick historical fact. It wasn't until after immigration was cut off in the early, partly as a result of World War I in 1914, and then restrictive legislation in the 1920s, that Blacks began to migrate north, dramatically increasing their income and getting industrial jobs. Before that, it didn't happen because the immigrants were taking all those jobs. And that is the other really, really important fact. We cut it off. And so when we look back at the Great Wave, we may tend to romanticize it because it ended. And that fact, and then immigration, in case your listeners don't know, stayed very low really until the 60s and 70s. The foreign-born, all the people who were not born in the United States, were less than 5% of the U.S. population by 1970, even though in 1910 it had been three times that. But by 1970 it was less than 5%. Again, today it's closing in on 16%, so something we've never had before. But that cutoff and that decade after decade of low immigration greatly facilitated the integration and assimilation of immigrants and their children and grandchildren. So that's the other big thing. So I guess if you had to say, well, technology, the cutoff, the attitude of elites, the rise of grievance, politics and identity-based politics, all of these things are very different. And so I think that that's why people, or many people anyway, sense something's not right. Something's very different than the past.
Well, and then we need to think about just the mechanism by which folks come into the country. I mean, in those great waves, I think for the most part, unless I'm mistaken, they came in an orderly and trackable way. And that, you know, it, that's not the case now with people streaming across the border. And which leads to my, my next question on some of the latest, controversies, from across the pond, where I think they've really experienced what might be a harbinger of what we could be looking at. And that's what I want to ask you about. And if you're just joining us, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Stephen Camerata, who is the director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies at CIS.org. I don't know if you caught this, this video that went viral on Twitter. Eva Vlardingerbrook, who at the CPAC in Hungary made quite a wave when she just basically took the gloves off and described what's going on in the Netherlands and across Europe in Brussels and other places with the mass migration and with the crime against people, women being assaulted on the streets, the murders that are occurring largely at the hands of immigrants that have come across in their open immigration system there. And I just wonder, with our unregulated illegal border crossings that we have, I mean, we hear a lot about it in the conservative channels about, oh, you know, and Donald Trump talks about, oh, they're giving us their worst. You know, we're getting the criminals and the rapists and the, you know, and then we hear the high profile stories. Could we be looking in America at what's happening in places like Sweden and the Netherlands and Belgium and other places in Europe with the way we have this unregulated illegal immigration overwhelming numbers coming across?
Well, there's a lot of complex questions there. Look, it's one of the things that's happened in Europe is the immigrants they get a lot of are from Africa and the Middle East, and they're asylum seekers. And so there is a certain unregulated notion to that, or I should say aspect to that. When you think about the social distance that people from, you know, some of the least developed parts of the world or some of the most religious parts of the world with a different religion. When you think about the social distance that those migrants have to traverse when they settle in a country that's highly secular and very different, like Sweden or France or Germany, the social disruption there can be enormous. And one of the men, those societies generally had, by our standards, very low rates of crime. And so you do see tremendous social turmoil, and the scale and numbers into those societies is extremely large as well, and very rapid. And so it's not surprising that there's a lot of pushback. Now, I don't claim to be an expert on European immigration, but obviously, given the numbers and given issues that are emerging, I think that they are rethinking profoundly what they're doing on migration. In the American context, in terms of crime, well-studied issue, well, heavily studied, but no good data or very limited data on the criminal behavior of immigrants. However, if you look at immigrants overall, their crime rates do not look to be extremely high relative to the U.S. born. But America has a high crime rate relative to other industrial countries too, so you have to preface it with that. In some places where we've had good data, like Texas, and we can single out illegal immigrants in Texas, it does look like for the most serious crimes like murder and sexual assault, the illegal immigrants in Texas do seem to have high crime rates, higher crime rates than the native born. And Texas is not a low crime rate state. So, overall, there is some evidence that there is also evidence that the children of immigrants often end up incarcerated at relatively high rates, an indication that maybe they have higher crime rates. So crime is a very complicated question. We could have a whole show on that. But overall, there does seem to be some evidence that certain subgroups and the U.S.-born children have higher crime rates. And there is some evidence that illegal immigrants in particular, but just very briefly, there are demographic reasons why the immigrants themselves won't have high crime rates. The highest crime rate for any group is men 16 to 24, and the average immigrant arrives after that age group. Other things are legal immigrants have to present documentation showing that they don't have a criminal record in their home country. And finally, criminals in the United States who are immigrants and not non-citizens anyway, get deported most, not always, but most of the time. Now, some come back and some fall through the cracks and don't get deported, but many do. Whereas our own criminals, U.S. born citizens, don't get deported after they serve their time. And so they tend to reoffend a lot. So these basic demographic facts should reduce overall immigrant criminality, though the data on illegals suggests that that may not be the case and that they may well have higher crime rates. And, of course, the illegal population is always changing. So what the data showed in 2018, we can really drill down into it, and the data is limited, keep that in mind, may not be true anymore. So it's always a changing target or changing set of circumstances. And it is, just one final point, it is maddening that states generally and the federal government don't do a great job of identifying the legal status, say, of their people that they incarcerate. And that makes this whole discussion all the more difficult.
Yeah, it is complex, and that's why as director of research we can rely on some real numbers, and there's enough real data out there to support some major change in policy, and we don't have time to go into it, but of course Joe Biden, it's being reported now, is looking at an executive order to limit migration to 4,000. I wonder why he waited till now to do that. Let me scratch my head. It takes about 2 seconds to figure out why, right? Hey, Steve, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for being with us as we continue through this election cycle. Hope to stay in touch with you and all of the great experts there at CIS, CIS.org, the Center for Immigration Studies. My guest, Stephen Camerota, today. Thanks very much, brother. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, there he is. Well, there you go. That's the skinny on the immigration situation. 314-912-1019, my number, if you'd like to weigh in on that. Are the other topics of the day? We have so many of them. We got Virginia Cruda coming up later this hour, Bill Eigel in the 8 o'clock hour, along with our capitalist ambassador from Germany. A lot coming up on the Tobler Show. Stay there.
Do you know what we're here for? You know we're here about
I don't think you know what you're here for.
Well, you're the one talking about. I
think your fake eyelashes are messing up.
No, I ain't nothing.
Hey, hold on.
How dare you attack the physical appearance of another person?
Are your feelings hurt?
Her words down.
Aww.
Oh, girl, baby girl.
Oh, really?
Don't even play,
baby. Why don't you debate me?
You're
self-evident.
You're not.
You don't have enough intelligence.
All right, so that was a little bit of the back and forth. The other day, and I think somewhere near the end of that, there might be something that needs to be bleeped, so we don't want to get in trouble with the FCC. But I will tell you, that little exchange between Representative Jasmine Crockett and Marjorie Taylor Greene in the House Oversight Committee was better than, ladies mud wrestling. I'm telling you, it was something to behold. Even Representative Raskin, Jamie Raskin, was like, oh my gosh, it was like a eye rolling emoji in real life. And he and then James Comer didn't know what to do. It was just hilarious to see those two going back and forth. Not one of the best moments in congressional history, right? Cheyenne, I mean, it was really something else.
People really tried to stifle their laughter. I heard in the background too, which was genuinely hilarious. they're actively trying to actually be representatives of the country and not absolute fools. Sometimes catfights have to happen, I guess.
Yeah, well, I guess that just maybe bespeaks of the passion that they have for the various positions, but I just thought it was not very becoming of our elected representatives in that forum. You know, there have been statesmen and women who make pithy and very effective statements that can be, well, a little bit personal, but sort of make a political point out of it rather than one of them was talking about the other's eyelashes. And then I think Crockett was commenting about MTG's very, but not directly, but saying something about a boss babe and I don't know, bleach blonde. And I mean, it was just, it was hilarious. Unbelievable. It just was
genuinely hilarious. She talked about,
I don't know.
Marjorie was talking about lashes, and then Crockett talks about her, the way her body's built, and it just, never in my life did I imagine the House of Representatives would be talking about this on the floor.
Yeah, I think it was like, it was sort of the House version of Mean Girls, you know? I
mean,
it was really special.
Literally, like name so, in book.
You know, we haven't heard much. I mean, I think it's, we've seen little eruptions across the states during the commencement ceremonies with people in their keffiyehs walking out of various commencement exercises and protests erupting here. We saw it in University of California, Irvine the other day. Well, in our fair city and at Washington University, my alma mater for medical school anyway, I'm an UMSL graduate for undergrad, but for med school, WashU, and it was painful for me to watch what happened the other day. I think you've got some sound on that, right, Cheyenne?
Yes, I do.
At the graduation there. Take a listen.
Washington University held its commencement with 3,400 graduates receiving diplomas. Also there, pro-Palestinian protesters.
While the ceremony took place, several pro-Palestinian groups rallied outside. Our Jacinta Cornell takes us to Washington University for this year's graduation.
Outside of Washington University's Francis Olympic Field Monday morning.
We will not stop. We will not rest. It's closed. Divest.
Graduates were greeted with chants.
We'll remember WashU.
Pro-Palestinian protesters rallied near this year's 163rd commencement.
I think that the message is clear. Divest, disclose, and drop the charges.
Once inside, 3,400 graduates embraced some of the changes for this year's ceremony. After on-campus protests almost 3 weeks ago, school leaders require tickets and clear bags. At the end of April, more than 100 people were arrested, and 23 students, along with 9 employees, were suspended. Changes are something this class is familiar with.
Something we've worked for 4 years.
All right, so they went on, and that report from KSEK talked about, you know, how, again, I think WashU suffered from the same malady that so many universities have. And there's been protests over the years and the decades, the young people getting all worked up over, first it was Vietnam, then, you know, other unrest. But I think in this case, I've never seen so much blind, zombie-esque protesting as I've seen during this latest thing. These kids, when you ask them, when reporters ask them, what do you know about that area? Tell us about, do you know what happened October 7th? Do you understand about this and that? They have no clue. When they say from the river to the sea, half of them think they're talking about from the Mississippi to the Atlantic. I mean, they have no clue. And some of them have as much admitted it. I remember a clip, Cheyenne, that from a few weeks ago, I think it was up at New York University. The reporter asked one of the young ladies there protesting, so do you know what brings you here? And she looked at her friend and said, well, it has something to do with Palestine, but I don't know much. Do you know what's going on? I mean, it was embarrassing. Well, what's been going on at the SIU campus where you you're in touch with, Cheyenne? Have there been a lot of protests there?
No, I haven't really seen much. I do know there was a teacher that is at that, in the faculty, I think the history department at SAUE, who was arrested at the WashU, protest. So that was interesting. So people have spoken out about that, but there really hasn't been much protest at SAUE. I guess they're trying to stay out of the fire.
Yeah. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I think most of us are, you know, say, hey, if you want to be vocal and you want to protest, that's fine. Protest, whatever. But I think it really, I mean, you know, your liberty to protest, you know, ends at my liberty to get across the quadrangle to go from here to there and get to my class or go to the student union or, you know, wherever I need to go. And I think that's where there's been so many problems, blocking entrances, blocking roadways, and obviously camping out on campus when it's not it's prohibited. And I don't know what it is about these kids that they don't understand that. I can't figure it out. Are you in touch with some different explanation for that makes sense? Because I can't find one.
First of all, I think like the right to protest, the right to free speech is one of the most important values of American culture. and of our Constitution. And there have definitely been attacks on that all across the country for against conservatives and liberals, against free speech. And I think that's something, a very dangerous trend that we ought to avoid, because if you don't like your speech being prohibited on your opinions on whatever, then you shouldn't be wanting to do the same thing to somebody who disagrees with you. That takes away so much of what is important about America. So I think it's important that people have the right to protest. But I do agree with you on, for example, for the WashU protest, I was actually on the way to rehearsal and Skinker Boulevard was completely shut down. I mean, the traffic was literally the worst I'd ever seen it in that area. And I got to rehearsal like an hour late and I was so upset.
No.
But it's like that, you know, that's maybe it's like a mild issue for me, but like I was just thinking about what if somebody's like, I don't know, in labor and like they're on the way to the hospital. Like this is the thing I thought about. You're protesting maybe like violence in another country, and I can understand why you're doing that, but you actually might be causing pain and damage right here, right now, because of your protesting. So I think like it's important again to share your opinions and to promote free speech, obviously on campuses especially. But the way that you do it is important, like you were saying. And if you're actively, literally, potentially like causing damage in someone's life, or maybe a first responder can't get through, whatever else, then that's where you lose me. So,
yeah. On the other hand, you know, I think that Governor Abbott had, I got kudos from I think several conservative corners a few weeks ago when he said, we're not going to allow anti-Semitic speech. You know, I mean, he was really cranking down on speech on the University of Texas campuses. And I have to tell you, I struggle with that. Now, this may be a touchy point for many of our listeners, but as much as we hate it, we have to defend the speech we hate as long as it's not inciting violence, as long as it's not promoting, well, physical violence against people. I think we have to do that. Think about the Nazis marching in Skokie, right? I mean, who wants to see Nazis marching in Skokie? But the Supreme Court said they had a right to do that. And I think that sometimes we can go too far and say, hey, there's something special about anti-Semitic speech that we can't allow that, but we can allow other kinds of so-called hate speech. We have to defend the abhorrent, the embarrassing for the speaker, hate speech, while at the same time calling it out for being absolutely reprehensible, absolutely hate speech, call it what you will. But I think that's where you cross the line. Now, if someone's on campus saying exterminate, John, Samuels, who is a Jewish student, that's a different thing than saying, I don't want to see the, I think we have to be careful about that. I don't know. Prime Minister Trudeau up in Canada, I think has borne this out, that it's not a good thing for us to prohibit what we would call hate speech. Again, if it incites violence, if it encourages, the murder of someone, the assault on someone, absolutely can't justify that.
Yeah. I mean, we've fought battles in the court over free speech. And this is one of the ones that have won, is that you are allowed to say whatever you want, as long as you're not literally saying, oh, well, we should go like kill all the Jews or something crazy that. Like then you're inciting violence. Then you actually are naming plans to cause harm.
Right.
But obviously there are so many things I disagree with. There are violent and aberrant and just rude things that people say or racist things that people say. Yeah. But I have like fallen on the side of being like, oh, people should not be allowed to say things like this. But then I've been talked down. Like, I've talked to my mom or like my grandma about certain things like this, cause we have differing opinions and we like to talk about these subjects. And I've changed my opinion on the fact that people should be allowed to say things, even though they could be hurtful or you completely disagree.
Yeah.
It's important as a society to share opinions that differ so we can all grow. And, maybe it's not. Maybe it's even lies, or maybe it's not what you want to hear, but restricting that is a slippery slope.
It's a really good point. And I think that it's lost on people who want the government to intervene and prohibit speech that offends them. And they forget maybe that will the next government then restrict their ability to speak negatively about some topic, some policy, some person for that matter, you know, that they would like to have free speech about. They, you know, for the time being, oh, this government's going to protect me from being, you know, offended by whatever. Well, watch out. The speech that you want to have restricted today may be your speech tomorrow. And I think we need to be careful about that. Well, we'll talk about some more cultural issues. We're going to get back into this Harrison Butker thing. I can't wait to hear what Virginia Cruda has to say about this when we come back on the Tobler Show. Virginia joins us then. And then we'll talk to a German historian, pro-capitalist author. At 8:06 and at 8:25, we'll wrap it up with some more. I imagine there'll be some fireworks when Bill Eigel joins us as well. So stay tuned for more on the Randy Tobler Show. Welcome back to the Tobler Show on News Talk STL 101.9 94.1. Thanks for being here with us this and every Saturday. Cheyenne is in for Jerome today. I don't know how she manages. I don't know how any of you guys manage all that board. It looks like the cockpit of a 747. I don't understand that. Thankfully, you know what you're doing up there, Cheyenne. Thanks for that.
Mm-hmm. Happy to be your pilot.
Virginia Cruda, contributor to the Daily Wire and frequent flyer here on News Talk STL, joins us. How you doing, Virginia? Having a good and enjoying the nice weather. Isn't it about time this global warming let up on us? We're having some sun. It's nice to see.
Yeah, it is nice today.
Yeah. Hey, I saw this story that you put up about this interesting New York Times story, mm-hmm, about briefly in front of the home of Justice Samuel Alito. Back in 21, I guess, an upside down flag flew, and it was put there by his wife. Unpack that story a little bit for the audience, would you?
Well, first off, you have to start with the New York Times, because they wanted this to be a hit piece telling us why Justice Alito shouldn't be trusted with anything related to election or election fraud or whatever. Mainly because what's in front of the Supreme Court right now? President Trump's immunity case.
Okay.
With regard to what he did after the 2020 election, as far as trying to prove that it wasn't Joe Biden's election, right? So They're trying to discredit Alito and force him to recuse himself, I guess, out of this. So here's what the New York Times does. They say that Justice Alito briefly flew a Stop the Steal flag outside his house. No, he didn't do any such thing. He didn't fly a flag that said Stop the Steal. He didn't voice support for Stop the Steal. He didn't voice any support whatsoever for what happened at the Capitol on January 6th. What happened was, on January 17th, an upside-down American flag was flown outside his house very briefly. Now, if you know anything about the upside-down American flag, it is not a Stop the Steal reference. It did not just start having meaning on January 6, 2021. The upside-down flag is a distress signal saying our country is in trouble. Or, more importantly, it was typically flown on a ship. If your flag was flown upside down, our ship has been taken over by pirates. Or our ship is in distress. Please help us. It was a symbol to the people around them to say, we need help here. So, that said, Justice Alito was asked about the flag, and he told the New York Times, no, that I didn't fly this flag. This was flown by my wife, and it was a dispute with a neighbor. And Shannon Bream, and that was all they covered in the New York Times story. And then they followed that with a series of quotes from multiple experts who said that morally and ethically, Justice Alito was still responsible for the fact that, and he might as well have simply put a flag that said Stop the Steal outside because of the sentiment of the day. So he should have known that that's how it would be interpreted and. That's how the New York Times framed the story. Well, Justice Alito talked to Shannon Bream, who is currently hosting Fox News Sunday, but she started out as a Supreme Court reporter for Fox News. So she knows her stuff, and she knows the justices, and she talked to Alito, and he said, look, this is what happened. So one of the neighbors put a sign in the window that said F Trump, and it was in clear view of kids as they went to their bus stop and waited for their bus on the street. And his wife said, you know what, I'm not sure that that is something I want to see in our neighborhood. And she made a comment about it. And that was that, in theory. Well, then they were out for a walk, and she and the same neighbor exchanged words, and there were some insults thrown at the Alitos, including the C word directed at his wife. And she, in response to that, briefly flipped the flag upside down in her home. The implication was that, hey, we are in there's an extreme political battle playing out in neighborhoods, not just in Washington, mm-hmm. but in regular neighborhoods, and this is not okay. And that was the sentiment behind flying the flag upside down. And so, of course, the New York Times got everything wrong and tried to make it about Justice Alito not being qualified to stand in judgment of anything related to election fraud. Because that's what they do.
Okay, so what I found interesting was, in your report, they implied that, in a way, since he's the master of the home, and I'm paraphrasing, but he has some kind of proxy responsibility for that, because after all, it's in front of his home. And mm-hmm. I thought, man, that sounds like an endorsement of the very patriarchy that the left typically disdains, right? It's like, you know, when they say, oh, a woman's... They don't like it when they always imply how us conservatives expect a woman to vote how their husband's going to vote. Wait a minute. Why aren't they defending Justice Alito's wife's right to say and do anything she wants? Why does her expression extend to him? I thought that was a very presumptuous assumption on their part.
Well, there's two things in play here. First, they're saying that because he holds a position of power, he should be paying more attention to what's going on, because even if he doesn't have control of his wife and what she does, he has to be wary of what it will look like for him if she behaves in that way.
Yeah.
Because he holds a position of power. That said, they also think Clarence Thomas should recuse himself because his wife has political opinions.
right.
So, I mean, the same thing is true on both. So I don't. But then you throw in the fact that they actually believe that all conservatives believe the same things in varying degrees, but they believe that all conservatives believe the same things that were espoused by Chief Skicker Harrison Butker, right? And they believe that conservatives all think that way, because on the left, everything is a monolith. They'll tell you that it's not, but it is. All conservatives think the same way. All women should think the same way, and when they don't, then you have a problem, and then you're a traitor to your sex. Of course, they can't define a woman, so that gets a little sticky now, but the idea that every Hispanic voter should think the same way, and every Black voter should think the same way, and every woman should think the same way, this is a very, very left idea. And I mean, and you've seen it play out in elections. So how could Black voters do that?
Yeah.
Well, because they're not all the same. Like, what's wrong with you people? But they want to tell you that they're not monoliths, but they are. And they believe you are. And that's the thing. So they believe that every conservative actually believes that the man is the head of the household. But they don't understand what that means, because they don't agree with it. So, like, you could be in a Christian family where the man is the head of the household, but that doesn't mean his wife doesn't disagree with him ever. Sometimes vocally, you know, that doesn't mean that That doesn't mean that she has different opinions about education, about politics, about anything. And but it just means that, I mean, like, it's no different than if you look at, say, look at the monarchy in England. Okay, King Charles is the head of state, right? Is Parliament always going to do what he wants them to? No.
No.
Of course not. But he's the head of state. How do you parse that? And so liberals don't understand the concept that you can have, because they believe, because you say a man is the head of the household, that he has all the power and the woman has no power.
Yeah.
And that's not how it is at all.
Yeah,
it's
a
division of power that's a different way, that's done in a different way than they're used to.
All right, so, okay, Virginia, I'm getting the signal here from Cheyenne. We only have a minute left, but how do you how do you come down on the fury and the firestorm over what Butker said about, hey, you gals are out there in the audience at Benedictine, you're getting your degrees, good for you, but boy, wait until you get married and have kids. I know many of you are going to realize what a great thing that is and how being a homemaker is one of the best things you can do. Well, okay, you got 35, 45 seconds. Go.
I think that there's nothing wrong with what he said, and that most of the people who are losing their minds about, quote, what he said, are losing their minds about something he didn't actually say, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
that's not to say I haven't seen quotes from him that aren't problematic, but in that speech, on that moment, considering who he was talking to, there's absolutely nothing wrong with what he said. And the thing is, he gets free speech just like the rest of us. So let him say what he wants.
All right. Well, we're going to have to unpack this more because I don't think we've heard the last of this interesting cultural conversation. Virginia, as always, thanks for joining me. Always appreciate your analysis. We'll see you next time.
Sure.
All right. There she is. We'll talk to you in a minute. Celebrate capitalism coming up.